Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
As Virginia lawmakers approach the end of the 2013 regular session of the General Assembly, talk heats up on how to spend your tax dollars in the coming years. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm A. Lily Lee. Thanks for joining us. This week, the House and Senate wrapped up work on its budget proposals, and now the spending plans are in the hands of a conference committee charged with ironing out the differences. So what's at stake? To discuss that and other issues still before the General Assembly, I'm joined by two guests who are keeping a close eye on Richmond these days. They are Bob Holsworth, who is managing principal of Decide Smart, and Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Welcome, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jeff, I know this is our tradition, so I'm just going to say Gong Hei Fa Choi and Happy New Year to you.
Mazel tov.
Thanks to both of you for being here this morning. We'd like to start off this morning with a little bit of information from Senator Walter Stosch, Republican senator from Henrico County in the Richmond area. He is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee on the state of the Senate budget. He's going to talk about that and on hurdles faced in the conference committee. He spoke within the past hour with our producer, Jerry Caldwell.
The Senate has its idea which and how much of the governor's proposals to adopt, and the House has, in this case, quite similar ideas. So we're now in the process of engaging in reconciling those differences. They're not significant in terms of most areas. There are some matters that we yet need to resolve.
For example, what might be the stumbling blocks?
Well, one of the major issues that we have before us is one that continues to plague us year after year, and that is how to address transportation needs. And that's both a policy matter and a funding matter, so the Finance Committee gets involved and the budget conferees become involved. The other issue is because of the successful passage of the national health care and the reelection of the president, then we are having to change our Medicaid program significantly, which also has a major financial impact. So we're addressing both of those. They are probably our two primary areas that need a lot of attention.
So like Governor Gilmore was known for cutting the car tax, do you believe Governor McDonnell will be known for cutting the gas tax?
Well, he does have a proposal to eliminate the gas tax, but he substitutes a sales tax for it. So one of the more difficult situations we have is that over time, most of us are paying considerably less gas tax than we did, and that's because we're driving further, better fuel economy. I think 20 years ago, I was paying 17.5 cents and driving 10 miles. Now I'm paying 17.5 cents and driving 25 miles. So the funding mechanism is outdated and has been eroded by our success in fuel economy. That's maybe a little bit of a nuance that most people don't realize. But because of that, the gas tax itself does not generate anywhere near the revenue that it did many years ago. So he has proposed eliminating the gas tax, which is 17.5 cents a gallon, and substituting some other methodology to recognize that over time it will get worse, because as fuel economy improves, then there will be less gas tax revenue coming in. So that's before us. We haven't resolved that yet. There are some who argue there ought to be a nexus between driving and paying for the roads. There are others who say, well, it's such a core service, let's simply use the sales tax as a means to fund it. And frankly, that's the debate going on just now, so there is no resolution to that yet.
Any predictions? Will there be a gas tax decrease or possibly an increase?
Well, there has to be more revenue, so it's just a question of, do you reduce the gas tax and increase something else, or how do you make up for it? He has proposed to add a few fees here and there and to use the sales tax and to use more general funds. That competes. The general fund is the fund from which schools and public safety and health care and other things are paid. So there is a tension as to just how to do it. There's no misunderstanding or disagreement that we must fix our transportation system. The only question is how to best do it.
And also joining us from Northern Virginia is Delegate Vivian Watts, Democrat from Fairfax County and a member of the House Finance Committee. Let's talk a little bit, Vivian, about what Walter Stosch just said. What do you make of the fact that even Republicans are wishy-washy about the governor's proposal to eliminate the car tax?
To eliminate the gas tax.
Sorry. I'm back in the whole early days of car tax.
Right. The push behind it is, let's say, premature. Over time, and I'm talking about year 2025, 2030, 35, the changes in the fuel efficiency requirements called CAFE standards will be fully in effect by 2025, but that'll only be the manufacturers have to basically double the fuel efficiency. They have to offer an average fleet, but as far as what the driving public buys, that will be something else. So that basically right now we're looking at less than 2% of the registered vehicles on Virginia's highways are fuel efficient. So 2%, and with a gasoline tax that ripples into all of the alternative fuels, including natural gas, electric cars, etc. We already have a tax structure that ripples and charges all of those vehicles for the road use. So over time, we may have to tweak and adjust this, but it's an overreaction, quite frankly, to say that because fuel cars are getting more efficient, we need to suddenly do away with the gas tax and not have this major tie between use of 95% of the vehicles out there and what we have to pay for when we pay for asphalt, which is a petroleum product, to repair the roads as well as deal with capacity. So that's why you're seeing a pushback. It just doesn't track. When I'm talking to the guys in the 7-Elevens, they're saying, what are you doing? It doesn't make sense. And so that's why you're seeing that kind of pushback. It doesn't have immediate crisis or logic.
And moving to Medicaid, again, the governor has stated that our state shouldn't be funding federal initiatives and we shouldn't have to come up with those monies. Where do Democrats stand on this?
The Democrats, and this is one where Walter Stosch has been very helpful in shaping constructive language, the Democrats very strongly feel that when you look at all the provisions on Medicaid waivers and what we would be able to do in addressing serious needs out there, where Virginia is basically 48th in the nation in our Medicaid spending. So there's a lot of things that we have not addressed, that we would save money, particularly in emergency room usage, where you have any number of people coming into the emergency rooms without any kind of coverage, and this has to be made up by all the people's insurance rates, all of the rates charged the people using hospitals. If we can pull more of these under the very generous federal spending match for Medicaid, Virginia would be well served. And also, if we don't do it, that money goes to other states. And it doesn't make sense not to look closely at everything that we can do under the new plan.
It was stated that the differences between the Senate proposal and the House proposal isn't that great. Do you agree?
It's the biggest change. The biggest two things are both the taking from the general fund for transportation, but specifically also the whole Medicaid, where the Senate, I think, is much more enlightened in looking at each provision and making sure what is cost beneficial as well as meeting legitimate health needs. In addition, you have a number of negative votes on the House side, particularly among Northern Virginia Democrats because of the money taken away from what is called cost to compete. It addresses the fact that you have very high cost of living in our area. So if you're raising teacher salaries, which is certainly needed, and you're not giving any adjustment for how much this is going to cost in Northern Virginia, as has been true for literally decades, and that is a provision that has been stripped out of the House budget as far as support personnel and reduced some considerably from the Senate budget as far as teacher salaries, that becomes another major issue in how these needs are met.
Delegate Vivian Watts of Fairfax County, as always, a pleasure to have you with us. Have a good day. All right, now back to Bob and Jeff. We want to talk a little bit about not only the overarching budget, but some of these ancillary issues as well. Jeff, why don't you start us off? We can start with the transportation package, since that seems to be huge right now. Can you give us an up-to-date on where we are, both on the House side and the Senate side?
The Senate initiative is tax-fattened. It'll generate about $900 million a year, if you believe the Senate Finance Committee's arithmetic. It would increase the fuel tax. It would add a trigger, an index, that would allow the tax to rise automatically as inflation climbs. It includes as well a regional or an option for a regional local sales tax that localities could use for transportation. That's very popular with Northern Virginia. Mind you, there are very few mechanisms anyone knows of for managing this regional transportation money, but we can discuss that later. The House bill is a somewhat diluted version or badly diluted version of the governor's bill. It preserves that swap that Delegate Watts mentioned, getting rid of the 17.5 cents per gallon fuel tax and replacing it with a 0.8% increase in the sales tax. Stripped out of it are those very controversial tolls for Interstate 95, a big McDonald initiative. Also these fees that owners of hybrid vehicles would pay the state, not using as much fuel as others. The House and Senate are really far apart. And the idea of stitching together something artful and effective and realistic, it depends on who you're talking to at certain times of the day. Some folks remain optimistic. A lot of people aren't. The governor clearly has a lot on the line. This is his last year in office. He's clearly looking for something that looks like a legacy. His previous attempts at transportation finance have been rejected by his own party often, as a bit rich on gimmicks and very short on cash. You'll recall the idea that somehow the royalties from offshore drilling for gas and oil could support not only our transportation system but higher education. And then, of course, there was the idea that the state should sell off its liquor monopoly, and those proceeds could go into roads as well.
That was Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And also joining us, as mentioned before, is Bob Holsworth, managing principal of Decide Smart. And by the way, tell us a little bit, Bob, about what Decide Smart does.
Oh, Meg Lilly, it's a company that I have with three partners, and we work with a lot of local governments trying to help them operate more effectively. And we work with some companies that try to find ways of assisting in that.
Okay. Going back to the budget, the Senate proposal raises about $900 million a year, considerably more than the Republican governor's plan if federal legislation he bets on does not come through. What is your take on what's going on here?
Well, you have a very clear tightrope that the governor is trying to operate on. On one hand, the governor really wants, as Jeff noted, a legacy on transportation. He wants to be able to say that he's the first governor since Gerald Baliles really to make an inroad on transportation funding and solving transportation issues in Virginia. At the same time, The governor has some national aspirations, national constituency, you might say, and he doesn't want to be put in the position of being said that he has simply raised taxes dramatically in order to do that. So what he's tried to do here is to come up with a plan that would be revenue neutral in the first year, but which would eventually give more revenue into transportation over time. Simultaneous with that, he wants to be known as the person who's actually cutting the price of gas, so that while he's raising more money for transportation, your sort of wallet at the pump will be a little heavier, because at the end of the day, you won't be paying as much out of your own purse as you did previously. So that's the tightrope he's trying to walk, and it's very, very difficult because the Senate simply doesn't agree with it. The Senate simply thinks taking away, as Vivian Watts said, the user fee component of paying for roads is really mistaken. And then secondly, they don't believe it costs – there's enough money into that. And then finally, on top of that, they don't think it's environmentally sound at all, because essentially what you're doing here is that you're taking away dollars that would be paid by people who have gas-guzzling cars, and you're now putting it on the sales tax entirely. And I guess finally, even if it's revenue neutral in the short term, it's not revenue neutral for Virginians. By taking the gas tax away, which is paid and also by people from out of state traveling through Virginia, essentially what you wind up doing is that you are increasing taxes on Virginians while you're reducing taxes on people from New Jersey, New York, and Florida. And I think that's the tension that has to be resolved. And as Jeff noted, it's a pretty significant tension.
And let me review about the only agreement between the Senate and House transportation plans were, number one, raising the vehicle registration fees by $15, and number two, the notion of giving a bigger slice of general fund revenue. And, of course, the amount of that is to be determined.
And I would note, May Lilly, and I suspect this was something that Delegate Watts was touching on as well. There is, if you will, the potential for something of a grand bargain here, in that we have a budget that needs to be reconciled, and all of the legislators have their snouts in it and want something that they can bring home. There is transportation, and then there is Medicaid expansion. They all are pieces of a big dollars and cents puzzle.
Okay, you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We'll be joined by Jeff Shapiro and Bob Holsworth right after this break, and more on the General Assembly. But first, I want to tell you that next week, Governor Doug Wilder joins us for a look back at his groundbreaking political career and talks about what he's up to now. That's next week on Virginia Conversations. Stay with us. We're back in a minute. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today, we're taking a closer look at goings-on at the General Assembly. Our guests today are Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Bob Holsworth, managing principal of DecideSmart. Two gentlemen who have been following state politics for, I don't know, as old as I am. For many, many years, and it's great to have both of you with us. Now, let's continue with Medicaid, Obamacare. Would Virginia comply by expanding Medicaid? It seems an interesting issue because one can see both sides of this coin. Let's start with you, Jeff.
The issue is one that divides Republicans as well. On the Senate side, Walter Stosch, whom we heard earlier, lays out the case for expansion of Medicaid and the possible savings associated with it. He has included in his version of the budget a mechanism by which Virginia would initially harvest these savings in return for a pledge from the federal government to bear down or help bear down on expenses. One wonders if this would provide the governor and maybe to some degree the Speaker of the House with a little bit of coverage to expand this coverage. I might add that that six Republican governors, including the governors of two states far more significant than Virginia and Michigan and Ohio, are all for Medicaid expansion. So this is not necessarily the third rail that that it may have been depicted as in the heat of a presidential campaign.
Bob, anything to add to that?
Well, I think Jeff has portrayed what the debate is extraordinarily well here. What you tend to have is most Republicans are saying they would agree with Medicaid expansion once reforms were implemented. And the question is about what are these reforms and what are the timing of these reforms. Others are saying that what we really have to do is to reform and expand simultaneously. And that'll be the way to ensure that Virginia will get the money that it needs from the federal government once Medicaid is expanded. And again, this is a pretty big political issue here in the state between part of the Republican Party and, not only Republicans but Democrats. And then beyond that, we have the lieutenant governor who's weighed in on this and said that he is for this simultaneous process of reform and expansion. The challenge to Virginia is that, once again, that if we don't take these dollars, if we don't find a way to expand Medicaid, as Delegate Watts said, those dollars that we are paying in taxes for the Affordable Care Act essentially go to other states. The second dilemma that you see is that you're hearing a lot from the hospital associations and particularly those hospitals that serve the Medicaid population, because right now they do get a particular kind of payment for serving the Medicaid population. And what they're worried about is that that payment is going to go way down without, just by statute. And at the same time, if Virginia doesn't expand Medicaid, what will happen is that they will wind up losing dollars because they won't get the Medicaid expansion dollars while their reimbursements are reduced by law. I happen to actually sit on the VCU Board of Visitors, and that was a discussion yesterday from our CEO of the hospital, who mentioned that without a Medicaid expansion, what will happen is that here is this entity that provides probably more Medicaid care than almost any entity in Virginia, and they will wind up having their reimbursements reduced without obtaining the federal dollars. So it's a real issue in the healthcare community as well as the political community.
And the healthcare providers have been losing money all along. The reimbursement rates have never kept track with the actual expenses. And, happened here is that the governor and the Speaker of the House, Bill Howell, made a bad political bet. They were wagering that that Mitt Romney would be president and the Republicans would take back control of the United States Senate and federal health care reform would be rolled back. And now we are literally months from when this law begins to take effect, and Virginia is essentially naked before the sun.
Fred from Hampton has a comment about corporate tax reform and the Virginia retirement system. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, I wanted to get the guest's take on any conversation going on about corporate tax reform and modifying the Virginia retirement system and tapping into that to generate some more revenue.
All right. Jeff, you want to take that?
Well, there was a good deal of discussion in previous years over doing away with the corporate income tax altogether. From the Richmond area, Republican State Senator Ryan McDougal carried that ball. This is very much kind of part of the conservative punch list. Doesn't seem to be much appetite for it now. As far as the retirement system is concerned, one of the big problems that Virginia faces is that its retirement system, its public retirement system, continues to carry a very substantial unfunded liability. Again, depending on whose arithmetic you believe, it's about $20 billion. In other words, were VRS to turn out the lights and pay out all of its obligations, it would come up $20 billion short. Governor McDonald and the legislature last year retooled the benefits scheme going forward for new employees and are trying essentially to move Virginia out of this kind of heavily paternalistic fixed benefit system to one of self-managed retirement benefits.
Okay. We've got a call from John from Virginia Beach. Go ahead, John. Good morning to you.
Hey, how's it going? I just had a question. Has there been any talk about the use of transponders, similar to like the Easy Pass system, where residents would have a transponder, and if you're from out of state, you just pay a toll or something like that?
Kind of like those devices to watch television viewing and monitor who's watching what.
Yeah, well, like the in Richmond, they have the you can use a you have a transponder in your car, go to the tolls really quick. Just have that on every car. I mean, had that been even brought up? I mean, I know there's a cost to it and a lot of people don't want to think they're paying taxes, but
that's great.
But they are. I mean, you're going to pay for it somehow, one way or another.
Right. Your point is well illustrated.
Well, it's actually been brought up in a slightly different context, and it's been brought up because there are a number of people who believe that the best user fee is actually to relate how much you pay in taxes, gas taxes, or taxes to the state in terms of the actual amount of mileage that you drive. And clearly there could be some kind of chip or transponder that everyone could have in their car that could actually track how much mileage. And at the end of the year, or every 3 months, you'd be responsible for a certain amount. A lot of people think that's actually the way to go. It's the fairest way to levy a user fee. But on the other hand, as you can imagine, it raises tremendous privacy concerns from people.
Oh, yeah.
And for that reason, I think the legislature, at least at the moment, until a whole host of other states do it, are a little reluctant to move in that direction.
And, John, yours is a voice I recognize. Oregon tried looking at this with on an experimental basis. I'm not entirely clear on how that unfolded. The Netherlands actually moved to this. It's essentially a mileage tax. There were a number of trade-offs made to put it in place. One actually pays for the time one spends on the road. There are discounts if one travels off-peak. There are premiums paid if one travels during those demand hours.
Great.
They have to give the governor credit because at least he, with the idea of taxing the hybrid cars and the electric cars and things like that, because at least it brought the conversation that you still have to pay for the roads no matter what kind of car you're driving. So.
Right, but the challenge to that framework was that at the same time the proposal was to tax the hybrid for a user fee, they were taking the gas tax off cars that were far less fuel efficient. So the challenge to the particular proposal is you wound up only taxing the hybrids while you were removing the tax off the SUVs. So I think you're absolutely right. Any number of states are trying to look to ensure that hybrids and particularly electric cars that may not be using any gas have a way to actually pay for the roads and the road maintenance. The challenge to the particular proposal that was in front of the General Assembly is that it put an extra fee on hybrids while it was actually removing all user fees off the SUVs.
And by doing away with the fuel tax, this was in effect a subsidy to the car industry. And that's sort of amusing given that Bob McDonald, the loyal Republican, was very outspoken in on the Obama administration bailout of the car business.
Great. John, thank you so much for your call. Have a good morning.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Earlier we had a call from Tom from Newport News, and he wants to ask, why not pay for transportation by reinstating the car tax? I know I had that slip of the tongue and went back to the Gilmore years. What do you think?
Well, the car tax was always a local tax. It was a tax that counties and cities imposed and collected every year, and it was usually in a single payment, which tended to annoy a lot of people. I mean, Governor Gilmore correctly identified that as sort of a dreaded institution. But the car tax actually continues to exist in a somewhat reduced form. It is a very expensive tax for the state, or at least the rollback is very expensive for the state, because Virginia reimburses localities for these reductions in the car tax, and that's costs Virginia about $1 billion a year. Now, that's about $1 billion a year that in general funds that I suspect a lot of legislators, Republicans and Democrats, would like to use for some of their pet projects.
That's Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Also joining us is Bob Holsworth, managing principal of Decide Smart. I'd like to move to gun rights. The legislature appears poised to keep secret the names of those with concealed weapons permits. I want to start with you, Jeff, on this issue.
This is a reaction to the tragedy in Newtown. A suburban New York newspaper got its nits on a list of concealed carry permit holders, their addresses, and posted it. This is not new. This was done in Virginia. The Roanoke Times posted a list on its website in 2007. It was taken down because there were concerns about identifying, allegedly there were concerns about identifying the victims of domestic violence. This is now on its way to the governor, and one assumes the governor will embrace it. Always been a little suspicious or somewhat suspect on gun rights. Remember, 1997, he supported the one handgun a month law that Governor Wilder pushed through, the first of its kind in the nation. And then last year, 2012, signed legislation to repeal it. So this may be another opportunity to underscore his pro-gun bona fides.
Bob, it seems interesting that whenever there is an event of national concern, especially a tragedy like this one, that legislation moves and people respond and react. It always seems more like an ebb and flow than an actual policy decision. We're reacting, we're responding because this thing happened. And then that has ramifications for years to come. Is that overreaching, or does that tend to be the case?
Well, that's always the case in public policy. Public policy is driven by a number of factors. Some might be economic conditions, but certainly big events always have potentially have a dramatic impact on public policy. What we've had here in Virginia, however, if you take a look at that, is really a fairly minimal impact that Sandy Hook has had, because there was a set of bills put forward, none of which are really gaining traction on the effort to restrict the access to guns here. And as you and Jeff just noted, we've had this one bill that's really related to privacy concerns, and that's been supported in this instance by people from both sides of the aisle. On one hand, the pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun folks believe that this is a horrific infringement on potential infringement on gun rights. And secondly, this whole issue of publishing the names of permit holders is also seen by a lot of other Democrats as another intrusion on privacy that is representative of a disturbing trend in the culture at large. So that's the one place where a bill's getting traction. Most of the Democratic efforts to restrict access to guns or to get rid of the gun show loophole, increase background checks, that's dying in the Virginia legislature right now.
The governor introduced a new panel to study school and campus safety. Would we say that this goes hand in hand, or is a completely different issue than the gun control issue?
I think it goes hand in hand to some extent. I think what it is that it's an effort to basically show that we could address and make schools safer, perhaps by putting more resource officers in school, while at the same time limiting, you might say, the efforts to promote school safety by restricting access to guns. So I think it's a smart political move on the part of the governor. It shows a responsiveness to the crisis, but at the same time, you'd have to say that it is also related to the political tactic of trying to ensure that some of the Democrats' efforts in this regard don't get much traction.
And the governor recognizes that Virginia is a state in which there is considerable tension on these issues. Yes, this is a heavily suburban state. Yes, the suburbs drive politics. But there is a continuing, vibrant gun tradition in Virginia, and that is something that is embraced by Republicans and Democrats as well.
One other point I would make here, May Lily, is that in Virginia, the Tea Party is not simply an entity that speaks about economic matters. That if you go to the Tea Party convention that they had a couple of years ago here in Richmond, it was really visible how important the gun rights issues and pro-Second Amendment issues were to members of the Tea Party. There were dozens of people who were involved in open carry who were there at that event. They have, in some instances, been highly critical of a person like Congressman Cantor, who is very closely aligned with the Tea Party in Washington, but at the same time highly criticized locally here in Richmond because he holds an event at a private entity, at a private at Innsbruck. He holds a big Republican event where they don't allow guns to be openly carried, and he's been blatantly criticized here in Richmond.
In 60 seconds, some camps would have us arm our teachers and administrators. Jeff?
This is a very tricky issue, and it's one that disturbs strong pro-gun Republicans, Bill Bowling, the lieutenant governor, among them. Of course, this may continue to feed the speculation about his presumed interest in an independent campaign for governor.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. We're back with more on Virginia's General Assembly in just a minute.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Today we're talking about this week's General Assembly. Our guests today are Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and also Bob Holsworth, managing principal of DecideSmart. Tom, you have a question.
Yes. Going back to the issue of registration fees on vehicles, I'm actually impacted by that. I bought a 2012 Prius plug-in electric vehicle last July and was very surprised to find out that I'm going to pay an extra $50 a year for registration, which, given my driving habits, is considerably more than I would have paid in gas taxes over the course of a year. I would be happy to pay a fee like that if it was going to build charging stations and incentivize using fuel-efficient vehicles, which seems to me is a national priority. If we step back from who's paying for what, don't we want to incentivize people to drive fuel-efficient cars? Isn't that in the national interest? And shouldn't we take that into consideration?
All right, Bob.
Well, that's the whole reason why so many people are opposed to the swap and getting rid of the gas tax, because they think it takes away all the incentive to move to more fuel-efficient vehicles. Because if you're driving a Prius now compared to someone who's getting 15 miles to the gallon in an SUV, you're paying one-third the one-third the gas tax. If all of a sudden you now impose a particular fee on the Prius, a special fee on the Prius, and take away the gas tax, that's where the plan comes up as short from the people who adopt a green perspective and who believe that it's in the public policy interest of the Commonwealth to be incentivizing more fuel efficiency on the road.
Appreciate your yeah.
Can I say that in my personal circumstance, I spent more money on this car than my annual salary is in a year. There's a crossover point where the additional fee that you paid for an electric vehicle will be made up by your savings in gasoline. And, of course, that depends on the future, your driving habits, the price of gas, some things that are unknown. But in any case, it's going to be 10 to 15 years at least before I make my money back, so to speak. So it's really an environmental decision that people like me are making, is an economic decision. And just to repeat the point, we need to incentivize green habits in our society. It's in the national interest to do that.
Yeah,
thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, we appreciate yours, Tom. Thank you so much. Wayne from Blacksburg, go ahead.
Yes, my question goes back to Medicaid and where the federal government will pay 90% of the cost. And I just wonder if they've questioned the thought that you're getting 90% from an entity that is borrowing 47% of the money it's spending. And in the past, on deals like this, the federal government has cut what they will pay to the states for similar type programs.
Jeff.
This is one of the issues that the governor raises, as well as the Speaker of the House, that the state will eventually be saddled with a bill that could bankrupt it, as it apparently has bankrupted the United States.
Right. And what's interesting is that this is an argument used at every level of government, because right now what's happened is that the federal government will pay 100% for some years and then will reduce to 90%. And one of the arguments that Republicans make and has a lot of resonance in Virginia, actually, is that the federal government's an unreliable partner. The irony, of course, is that if you took a look at the debate in Virginia between the state government and local governments continually say that the state government is an unreliable partner as well. But the reality is that given the distrust that is so rampant about the federal government today, the argument that the federal government will not be reliable, will not meet its responsibilities, will not live up to its obligations, it won that has an enormous amount of resonance in the General Assembly right now.
And the great paradox, if not irony, it's an article of faith that a Virginia politician is going to decry the presumed excesses of the federal government, particularly when it comes to spending your money and mine. But look at the Virginia economy. 26% of it is directly tied to federal largesse.
Thank you so much for your call, Wayne. I want to move to another issue, that is voter registration. Many feel and know from experience that Virginia is in need of voter registration overhauls. It's hard for many to simply vote. And now we are looking at a measure that might make voter ID laws even tougher. Jeff?
This is a tricky issue. It is a tricky issue for the governor. He tried to soften the first voter ID law, the one passed last year. He ran into some difficulties with the conservative Republican majority in the House of Delegates. The governor then issued an executive order directing the Board of Elections to issue fresh ID cards to all 5 million voters. That was at a cost of about $1.3 million. Now, the Republicans are pushing the idea of a photo ID, one that the state would issue at state cost. That's assuming the budget writers of the General Assembly go along with it. And if it's approved, it would not take effect until 2014, after Governor McDonnell leaves office. So I think implicit in there is an acknowledgement by the Republicans in the legislature who are pushing this bill that this governor may be a bit of an obstacle. To opponents, this is nothing more than a chance to discourage people from exercising the franchise. And one need only look at the makeup of the new Virginia. This is a state with a fast-growing Asian and Latino population. This is a fast-growing Latino and Asian population that is increasingly hostile to Republicans.
Bob?
Well, this issue has become so politically controversial largely because of the fact that we last year had the governor issue these new voter registration cards to everyone. And so what the Democrats are saying on one hand here is that there's really no evidence of fraud. We've just been through an election. Virginia's election was overall very, very clean, no evidence of widespread fraud. So why do we need to take another step to fix a problem that, from the Democrats' perspective, doesn't exist? On the other hand, the potential for voter fraud is an issue that resonates very, very deeply with the Republican electorate. I give a lot of talks around the state, and I hear this all the time when you speak with Republican groups about the concern that voter fraud has and what's wrong with having a photo ID. Beyond this, this is now entered into 2013 politics, because the chief proponent of this bill in the Senate is Senator Obenshain, and he's running for the Attorney General nomination in the Republican Party against Rob Bell from Charlottesville, Delegate Bell, who is the chief proponent of the Tebow bill in the Assembly this year. So what you have is that you have people who are making arguments that resonate, again, very deeply with the base of their own party, and then secondly is looked at as a potential signature bill in a nomination fight.
And these issues really have to be viewed through the filter of federal law and race. Virginia is a voting rights state because of its long history of discriminatory election laws. Any changes in our election laws, and that includes voter ID, have to be approved by the Justice Department. The most recent law was approved by DOJ, but some of these photo ID laws have been challenged by the Justice Department in states such as Pennsylvania and South Carolina. By the way, states that currently have Republican governors.
Well, you know, and what Jeff said is so interesting here, because this bill is tailored very, very carefully to try to find a way to thread the needle in order to obtain Justice Department approval of photo IDs. They're very, very careful to say they're trying to fund these IDs at a level so that they actually will not cost anything to any citizen, that they can actually get it for free. They just have to request. And they're hoping that that funding mechanism will enable the Justice Department to say that these are not discriminatory. But Jeff is exactly right. Even when this passes the Assembly, it then goes – it will then – and if the governor signs off on it, it will then go to the Justice Department, and it will be fascinating to see how the Obama Justice Department responds to Virginia's effort to thread the needle, you might say, on photo ID laws.
That's Bob Holsworth, managing principal of Decide Smart. We're also joined by Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Kenneth from Charlottesville, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the gas tax versus the sales tax. I have not driven a car in 20 years, so I pay no gasoline tax. Yet I am dependent upon all of my goods and services be accessible to me by the Virginia roads. So the only way I can be contributing to the roads that I so desperately need is if I'm paying it through the sales tax. Also, the people from New Jersey, if they come to Virginia, if they may not be paying the gas tax, but they'll be paying sales tax. Now, and one more thing, and I'll let you go. I have a Virginia identification card. I'm required by state law to have a Virginia identification card since 1998, since I don't have a driver's license. I carry it in my wallet with me at all times. And so in Virginia, we are already required to have a picture ID that I have to go up to the DMV to ever so often get a fresh picture.
Right. Okay, we'll take both of those. Thank you so much, Kenneth. Let's start, Jeff, with the issue of a car tax. It's, you know, someone who doesn't drive, it's kind of like a non-smoker not having to pay the cigarette tax.
Well, the governor's bill, speaking of artful, calls for this increase in the sales tax to go to transportation, but the tax itself would not apply to fuel or food. What it would apply to are all those other essentials for a long car trip, a new suitcase, a bottle of shampoo, or a tin of shaving cream. And again, I think this speaks to a certain awkwardness that even the governor has acknowledged. And even some of the more conservative members of his party. John Cox, who is a Republican delegate from Hanover County, a very successful trucking executive, he's all for keeping the fuel tax and says he hasn't heard anyone complain about the Virginia fuel tax, and most people seem perfectly content to keep it.
All right. Another issue that Kenneth brought up, Bob, is getting out there to the polls, weighing voter fraud against voting accessibility.
Right. And what he argues is really a point that a lot of people make. They argue that for many daily activities in life today, it's almost unimaginable that people don't have some kind of photo ID in order to conduct business, in order to go to a bank, in order to do the kind of things that almost everyone would have to do to get through their daily activities. So what's the big deal here is his argument. On the other hand, you have some Democrats who basically say there are some people who don't have photo government-issued IDs, and they're likely to be either ethnic minorities or people who are young or people who are extremely old. And in those ways, you could have a discouraging factor here. If they need to do something special in order to get that ID, maybe they won't do that. Maybe they won't go to the polls. And at the end of the day, that's the political tension you have here. And ultimately, if Virginia passes this bill, it'll be up for the Justice Department to make a decision. And then based on that decision, you could even have a court case that comes up about.
Let's talk about a related issue, and that is redistricting in Virginia. Jeff, Senator Janet Howell made an interesting move. Explain how this sort of shifts the power on the House, on the Senate side.
I think you are speaking to the Republican attempts at redistricting, and this is part of a bigger picture challenge in Virginia politics, and that's this changing electorate. Republicans are aware of this. One of their concerns is that this new demographic wave will have an effect at the local level, when there are typically lower turnout affairs, and that, coupled with these very artfully placed lines, can assure the re-election of Republicans in areas that look outwardly Democratic and vice versa. That bill or that effort was tacked onto a House bill that was then sent over to the House for its approval and was then thrown out as irrelevant, the argo of the legislature, not germane by the Speaker of the House. And the Speaker gets a lot of credit for doing that, but he waited 16 days to do so because the Republicans clearly tried to use that redistricting bill as a way to apply pressure on Democrats to come around on things like the budget and transportation.
Right. Bob, anything else to add to that?
Well, this was a pretty remarkable bill because what it would have done is that it would have actually increased Republican representation in the Senate probably by 5 or 6 seats, giving them perhaps not the same kind of majority they hold in the House, but a very significant one. And the other thing that this raised, the other issue it raised, was the prospect of perpetual redistricting every time you had an election. Because we've just been through the redistricting once, and if this had gone through, you could be you would have changed the entire nature of redistricting from something that happens every 10 years to something that happens every time you gain a political majority and political power. You would then try to institutionalize and enshrine it for years. So this contaminated and poisoned the atmosphere in the assembly tremendously, and I don't think the tensions have gone away.
All right. That really rounds out our show, Bob. Thank you so much, both of you, Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Bob Holsworth, managing principal of Decide Smart. We appreciate your joining us today, and thank you for all of your calls on this edition of Virginia Conversations. Next Friday at 9, a visit with Virginia's first African-American governor, Doug Wilder. That's next Friday on Virginia Conversations. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.